Sometimes it feels like the world is moving at hyperspeed and you can't keep up because it's one thing, then another, and don't forget the meeting and the yoga class and the dinner reservation, but then you get into the all-new Nissan Murano, and you feel the breeze from the panoramic moonroof, while the massaging seats melt away the tension of the day. And you realize that sometimes the greatest rush is not rushing at all. Shop the all-new Murano at NissanUSA.com. Panoramic moonroof, massaging leather-appointed seats are available features.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Chapter 6 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 6. Jerry to the Rescue. It was not long before Pollyanna reached the edge of the garden at a corner where two streets crossed. It was a wonderfully interesting corner, with its hurrying cars, automobiles, carriages, and pedestrians. A huge red bottle in a drugstore window caught her eye, and from down the street came the sound of a hurdy-gurdy. Hesitating only a moment, Pollyanna darted across the corner and skipped lightly down the street toward the entrancing music. Pollyanna found much to interest her now. In the store windows were marvelous objects, and around the hurdy-gurdy, when she had reached it, she found a dozen dancing children, most fascinating to watch. So altogether delightful indeed did this pastime prove to be, that Pollyanna followed the hurdy-gurdy for some distance, just to see those children dance. Presently she found herself at a corner so busy that a very big man in a belted blue coat helped the people across the street. For an absorbed minute she watched him in silence. Then, a little timidly, she herself started to cross. It was a wonderful experience. The big, blue-coated man saw her at once and promptly beckoned to her. He even walked to meet her. Then, through a wide lane with puffing motors and impatient horses on either hand, she walked unscathed to the further curb. It gave her a delightful sensation, so delightful that after a minute she walked back. Twice again, after short intervals, she trod the fascinating way so magically opened at the lifting of the big man's hand. But the last time her conductor left her at the curb, he gave a puzzled frown. "See here, little girl, ain't you the same one what crossed a minute ago?" he demanded. "And again before that?" "Yes, sir," beamed Pollyanna. "I've been across 4 times." "Well!" The officer began to bluster, but Pollyanna was still talking. "And it's been nicer every time." "Oh, it has it?" mumbled the big man lamely. Then with a little more spirit he sputtered, "What do you think I'm here for, just to tote you back and forth?" "Oh, no, sir," dimpled Pollyanna. "Of course you aren't just for me. There are all these others. I know what you are. You're a policeman. We've got one of you out where I live at Mrs. Carew's, only he's the kind that just walks on the sidewalk, you know. I used to think you were soldiers on account of your gold buttons and blue hats, but I know better now. Only I think you are a kind of a soldier, 'cause you're so brave, standing here like this, right in the middle of all those teams and automobiles, helping folks across." "Ho, ho! Brrr!" spluttered the big man, coloring like a schoolboy and throwing back his head with a hearty laugh. "Ho, ho! Just as if—" He broke off with a quick lifting of his hand. The next moment he was escorting a plainly very much frightened little old lady from curb to curb. if his steps were a bit more pompous and his chest a bit more full, it must have been only an unconscious tribute to the watching eyes of the little girl back at the starting point. A moment later, with a haughtily permissive wave of his hand toward the chafing drivers and chauffeurs, he strolled back to Pollyanna. "Oh, that was splendid!" she greeted him with shining eyes. "I love to see you do it, and it's just like the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea, isn't it? With you holding back the waves for the people to cross? And how glad you must be all the time that you can do it! I used to think being a doctor was the very gladdest business there was, but I reckon, after all, being a policeman is gladder yet. To help frighten people like this, you know, and..." But with another brrrr and an embarrassed laugh, the big, blue-coated man was back in the middle of the street, and Pollyanna was all alone on the curbstone. For only a minute longer did Pollyanna watch her fascinating Red Sea. Then, with a regretful backward glance, she turned away. "I reckon maybe I'd better be going home now," she meditated. "It must be most dinner-time." And briskly she started to walk back by the way she had come. Not until she had hesitated at several corners and unwittingly made two false turns did Pollyanna grasp the fact that going back home was not to be so easy as she had thought it to be. And not until she came to a building which she knew she had never seen before did she fully realize that she had lost her way. She was on a narrow street, dirty and ill-paved. Dingy tenement blocks and a few unattractive stores were on either side. All about were jabbering men and chattering women, though not one word of what they said could Pollyanna understand. Moreover, she could not help seeing that the people looked at her very curiously, as if they knew she did not belong there. Several times already she had asked her way, but in vain. No one seemed to know where Mrs. Carew lived, and the last two times those addressed had answered with a gesture and a jumble of words which Pollyanna, after some thought, decided must be Dutch, the kind the Hagermans, the only foreign family in Beldingsville, used. On and on, down one street and up another, Pollyanna trudged. She was thoroughly frightened now. She was hungry, too, and very tired. Her feet ached, and her eyes smarted with the tears she was trying so hard to hold back. Worse yet, it was unmistakably beginning to grow dark. "Well, anyhow," she choked to herself, "I'm going to be glad I'm lost, 'cause it'll be so nice when I get found. I can be glad for that." It was at a noisy corner where two broader streets crossed that Pollyanna finally came to a dismayed stop. This time the tears quite overflowed, so that, lacking a handkerchief, she had to use the backs of both hands to wipe them away. "Hello, kid, why the weeps?" queried a cheery voice. "What's up?" With a relieved little cry, Pollyanna turned to confront a small boy carrying a bundle of newspapers under his arm. "Oh, I'm so glad to see you," she exclaimed. "I've so wanted to see someone who didn't talk Dutch." The small boy grinned. "Dutch nothing," he scoffed. "You mean Dago, I bet ye." Pollyanna gave a slight frown. "Well, anyway, it wasn't English," she said doubtfully, "and they couldn't answer my questions. But maybe you can. Do you know where Mrs. Carew lives?"
"Nix. You can search me."
"What?" queried Pollyanna, still more doubtfully. The boy grinned again. "I say, not in mine. I guess I ain't acquainted with the lady." "But isn't there anybody anywhere that is?" implored Pollyanna. "You see, I just went out for a walk and I got lost. I've been ever and ever so far, but I can't find the house at all. And it's dinner time and getting dark. I want to get back. I must get back."
"Gee, well, I shouldn't worry," sympathized the boy.
"Yes, and I'm afraid Mrs. Carew'll worry, too," sighed Pollyanna.
"Gorry, if you ain't the limit," chuckled the youth unexpectedly. "But say, listen, don't you know the name of the street you want?"
"No, only that it's some kind of an avenue," desponded Pollyanna.
"A avenue, is it? Sure now, some class to that. We're doin' fine. What's the number of the house? Can you tell me that? Just scratch your head."
"Scratch my head?" Pollyanna frowned questioningly and raised a tentative hand to her hair. The boy eyed her with disdain.
"Ah, come off your perch. Ye ain't so dippy as all that. I say, don't ye know the number of the house you want?"
No, except there's a 7 in it," returned Pollyanna with a faintly hopeful air.
"Won't you listen ter that?" jibed the scornful youth. "There's a 7 in it, and she expects me ter know it when I see it."
"Oh, I should know the house, if I could only see it," declared Pollyanna eagerly. "And I think I'd know the street, too, on account of the lovely long yard running right up and down through the middle of it." This time it was the boy who gave a puzzled frown.
"Yard?" he queried. "In the middle of a street?"
"Yes, trees and grass, you know, with a walk in the middle of it, and seats, and—" But the boy interrupted her with a whoop of delight.
"Gee whiz, Commonwealth Avenue, sure as you're livin'. Wouldn't that get your goat now?"
"Oh, do you know? Do you really?" besought Pollyanna. "That sounded like it. Only, I don't know what you meant about the goat part. There aren't any goats there. I don't think they'd allow."
"Goats nothin'," scoffed the boy. "You bet your sweet life I know where 'tis. Don't I tote Sir James up there to the garden most every day? And I'll take you, too. Just you hang out here till I get on ter my job again and sell out my stock. Then we'll make tracks for that air avenue, for you can say Jack Robinson."
"You mean you'll take me home?" appealed Pollyanna, still plainly not quite understanding.
"Sure, it's a cinch, if you know the house."
"Oh, yes, I know the house," replied the literal Pollyanna anxiously. "But I don't know whether it's a cinch or not. If it isn't, can't you—"
But the boy only threw her another disdainful glance and darted off into the thick of the crowd. A moment later, Pollyanna heard his strident call of, "Paper, paper, Herald, Globe, paper, sir?" With a sigh of relief, Pollyanna stepped back into a doorway and waited. She was tired, but she was happy. In spite of sundry puzzling aspects of the case, she yet trusted the boy, and she had perfect confidence that he could take her home.
"He's nice, and I like him," she said to herself, following with her eyes the boy's alert, darting figure.
"But he does talk funny. His words sound English, but some of them don't seem to make any sense with the rest of what he says. But then, I'm glad he found me. Anyway," she finished with a contented little sigh. It was not long before the boy returned, his hands empty.
"Come on, kid, all aboard," he called cheerily. "Now we'll hit the trail for the avenue. If I was the real thing now, I'd tote you home in style, in a buzz wagon. But seein' as how I hain't got the dough, we'll have ter hoof it."
It was, for the most part, a silent walk. Pollyanna, for once in her life, was too tired to talk, even of the ladies' aiders, and the boy was intent on picking out the shortest way to his goal. When the public garden was reached, Pollyanna did exclaim joyfully,
"Oh, now I'm most there. I remember this place. I had a perfectly lovely time here this afternoon. It's only a little bit of a ways home now."
"That's the stuff. Now we're gettin' there," crowed the boy. "What did I tell ye? We'll just cut through here to the avenue, and then it'll be up ter you to find the house."
"Oh, I can find the house," exulted Pollyanna, with all the confidence of one who has reached familiar ground.
It was quite dark when Pollyanna led the way up the broad Carew steps. The boy's ring at the bell was very quickly answered, and Pollyanna found herself confronted by not only Mary, but Mrs. Carew, Bridget, and Jenny as well. All four of the women were white-faced and anxious-eyed. "Child, child, where have you been?" demanded Mrs. Carew, hurrying forward.
"Why, I just went to walk," began Pollyanna, "and I got lost, and this boy..."
"Where did you find her?" cut in Mrs. Carew, turning imperiously to Pollyanna's escort, who was, at the moment, gazing in frank admiration at the wonders about him in the brilliantly lighted hall. "Where did you find her, boy?" she repeated sharply. For a brief moment the boy met her gaze unflinchingly. Then something very like a twinkle came into his eyes, though his voice, when he spoke, was gravity itself.
"Well, I found her round Bowdoin Square, but I reckon she's been doin' the North End, only she couldn't catch on ter the lingo of the Dagos, so I don't think she give 'em the glad hand, ma'am."
"The North End? That child alone?" "Pollyanna!" shuddered Mrs. Carew.
"Oh, I wasn't alone, Mrs. Carew," fended Pollyanna. "There were ever and ever so many people there, weren't there, boy?"
But the boy, with an impish grin, was disappearing through the door. Pollyanna learned many things during the next half hour. She learned that nice little girls do not take long walks alone in unfamiliar cities, nor sit on park benches and talk to strangers. She learned also that it was only by a perfectly marvelous miracle that she had reached home at all that night, and that she had escaped many, many very disagreeable consequences of her foolishness. She learned that Boston was not Beldingsville, and that she must not think it was. "But, Mrs. Carew," she finally argued despairingly, "I am here, and I didn't get lost for keeps. Seems as if I ought to be glad for that, instead of thinking all the time of the sorry things that might have happened."
"Yes, yes, child, I suppose so. I suppose so," sighed Mrs. Carew. "But you have given me such a fright, and I want you to be sure, 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 never to do it again. Now come, dear, you must be hungry."
It was just as she was dropping off to sleep that night that Pollyanna murmured drowsily to herself, "The thing I'm the very sorriest for of anything is that I didn't ask that boy his name, nor where he lived. Now I can't ever say thank you to him." End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 7. A New Acquaintance. Pollyanna's movements were most carefully watched over after her adventurous walk. And except to go to school, she was not allowed out of the house unless Mary or Mrs. Carew herself accompanied her. This to Pollyanna, however, was no cross, for she loved both Mrs. Carew and Mary, and delighted to be with them. They were, too, for a while, very generous with their time. Even Mrs. Carew, in her terror of what might have happened, and her relief that it had not happened, exerted herself to entertain the child. Thus it came about that, with Mrs. Carew, Pollyanna attended concerts and matinees, and visited the public library and the art museum. And with Mary she took the wonderful Seeing Boston trips, and visited the State House and the Old South Church. Greatly as Pollyanna enjoyed the automobile, she enjoyed the trolley cars even more, as Mrs. Carew, much to her surprise, found out one day. "Do we go in the trolley car?" Pollyanna asked eagerly. "No, Perkins will take us," answered Mrs. Carew. Then, at the unmistakable disappointment in Pollyanna's face, she added in surprise, "Why, I thought you liked the auto, child." "Oh, I do," acceded Pollyanna hurriedly, "and I wouldn't say anything anyway, because, of course, I know it's cheaper than the trolley car, and—" cheaper than the trolley car," exclaimed Mrs. Carew, amazed into an interruption. "Why, yes," explained Pollyanna, with widening eyes. "The trolley car costs 5 cents a person, you know, and the auto doesn't cost anything, 'cause it's yours. And, of course, I love the auto anyway," she hurried on, before Mrs. Carew could speak. "It's only that there are so many more people in the trolley car, and it's such fun to watch them, don't you think so?" "Well, no, Pollyanna, I can't say that I do," responded Mrs. Carew, dryly, as she turned away. As it chanced, not 2 days later, Mrs. Carew heard something more of Pollyanna and trolley cars, this time from Mary. "I mean, it's queer, ma'am," explained Mary earnestly, in answer to a question her mistress had asked. "It's queer how Miss Pollyanna just gets round everybody and without half trying. It isn't that she does anything, she doesn't. She just looks glad. I guess that's all. But I've seen her get into a trolley car that was full of cross-looking men and women and whimpering children, and in 5 minutes you wouldn't know the place. The men and women have stopped scowling, and the children have forgot what they are crying for. Sometimes it's just something that Miss Pollyanna has said to me, and they've heard it. Sometimes it's just the thank you she gives when somebody insists on giving us their seat. And they're always doing that, giving us seats, I mean. And sometimes it's the way she smiles at a baby or a dog. All dogs everywhere wag their tails at her, anyway, and all babies, big and little, smile and reach out to her. If we get held up, it's a joke, and if we take the wrong car, it's the funniest thing that ever happened. And that's the way 'tis about everything. One just can't stay grumpy with Miss Pollyanna, even if you're only one of a trolley car full of folks that don't know her." "Very likely," murmured Mrs. Carew, turning away. October proved to be that year a particularly warm, delightful month, and as the golden days came and went, it was soon very evident that to keep up with Pollyanna's eager little feet was a task which would consume altogether too much of somebody's time and patience. And while Mrs. Carew had the one, she had not the other. Neither had she the willingness to allow Mary to spend quite so much of her time, whatever her patience might be, in dancing attendance to Pollyanna's whims and fancies. To keep the child indoors all through those glorious October afternoons was, of course, out of the question. Thus it came about that before long Pollyanna found herself once more in the lovely big yard, the Boston Public Garden, and alone. Apparently she was as free as before, but in reality she was surrounded by a high stone wall of regulations. She must not talk to strange men or women, she must not play with strange children, and under no circumstances must she step foot outside the garden except to come home. Furthermore, Mary, who had taken her to the garden and left her, made very sure that she knew the way home, that she knew just where Commonwealth Avenue came down to Arlington Street across from the garden. And always she must go home when the clock in the church tower said it was 4:30. Pollyanna went often to the garden after this. Occasionally she went with some of the girls from school. More often she went alone. In spite of the somewhat irksome restrictions, she enjoyed herself very much. She could watch the people, even if she could not talk to them. And she could talk to the squirrels and pigeons and sparrows that so eagerly came for the nuts and grains which she soon learned to carry to them every time she went. Pollyanna often looked for her old friend of that first day, the man who was so glad he had his eyes and legs and arms, and the pretty young lady who would not go with the handsome man. But she never saw them. She did frequently see the boy in the wheelchair, and she wished she could talk to him. The boy fed the birds and squirrels, too, and they were so tame that the doves would perch on his head and shoulders, and the squirrels would burrow in his pockets for nuts. But Pollyanna, watching from a distance, always noticed one strange circumstance. In spite of the boy's very evident delight in serving his banquet,
his supply of food always ran short almost at once, and though he invariably looked fully as disappointed as did the squirrel after a nutless burrowing, yet he never remedied the matter by bringing more food the next day, which seemed most short-sighted to Pollyanna. When the boy was not playing with the birds and squirrels, he was reading, always reading. In his chair were usually two or three worn books, and sometimes a magazine or two. He was nearly always to be found in one especial place, and Pollyanna used to wonder how he got there. Then one unforgettable day she found out. It was a school holiday, and she had come to the garden in the forenoon, and it was soon after she reached the place that she saw him being wheeled along one of the paths by a snub-nosed, sandy-haired boy. She gave a keen glance into the sandy-haired boy's face, then ran toward him with a glad little cry. "Oh, you! You! I know you, even if I don't know your name. You found me! Don't you remember? Oh, I'm so glad to see you! I've so wanted to thank you!" "Gee, if it ain't the swell little lost kid of the avenue," grinned the boy. "Well, what do you know about that? Lost again?" "Oh, no," exclaimed Pollyanna, dancing up and down on her toes in irrepressible joy. "I can't get lost any more. I have to stay right here. And I mustn't talk, you know. But I can to you, for I know you. And I can to him after you introduce me," she finished, with a beaming glance at the lame boy and a hopeful pause. The sandy-haired youth chuckled softly and tapped the shoulder of the boy in the chair. "Listen ter that, will ye? Ain't that the real thing now? Just you wait while I introduce ye," and struck a pompous attitude. "Madame, this is me friend, Sir James, Lord of Murphy's Alley, and—" But the boy in the chair interrupted him. "Jerry, quit your nonsense," he cried vexedly. Then to Pollyanna he turned a glowing face. "I've seen you here lots of times before. I've watched you feed the birds and squirrels. You always have such a lot for them. And I think you like Sir Launcelot the best, too. Of course, there's Lady Rowena. But wasn't she rude to Guinevere yesterday, snatching her dinner right away from her like that?" Pollyanna blinked and frowned, looking from one to the other of the boys in plain doubt. Jerry chuckled again. Then, with a final push, he wheeled the chair into its usual position and turned to go. Over his shoulder he called to Pollyanna. "Say, kid, just let me put you wise ter somethin'. This chap ain't drunk nor crazy, see? Them's just names he gives his young friends here," with a flourish of his arms toward the furred and feathered creatures that were gathering from all directions. "And they ain't even names of folks, they're just out of books. Are ye on? Yet he'd rather feed them than feed hisself. Ain't he the limit? Ta-ta, Sir James," he added with a grimace to the boy in the chair. "Buck up now. Nix on the no-grub racket for you. See ye later." Pollyanna was still blinking and frowning when the lame boy turned with a smile. "You mustn't mind Jerry. That's just his way. He'd cut off his right hand for me, Jerry would. But he loves to tease. Where'd you see him? Does he know you? He didn't tell me your name." "I'm Pollyanna Whittier. I was lost, and he found me and took me home," answered Pollyanna, still a little dazedly. "I see. Just like him," nodded the boy. "Don't he tote me up here every day?" A quick sympathy came to Pollyanna's eyes. "Can't you walk at all, Sir James? The boy laughed gleefully. "Sir James, indeed! That's only more of Jerry's nonsense. I ain't a sir." Pollyanna looked clearly disappointed. "You aren't? Nor a lord, like he said?" "I sure ain't." "Oh, I hoped you were. Like little Lord Fauntleroy, you know," rejoined Pollyanna. But the boy interrupted her with an eager, "Do you know little Lord Fauntleroy? And do you know about Sir Lancelot and the Holy Grail, and King Arthur and his Round Table, and the Lady Rowena and Ivanhoe and all those? Do you?" Pollyanna gave her head a dubious shake.
"Well, I'm afraid maybe I don't know all of them," she admitted. "Are they all in books?" The boy nodded. "I've got 'em here, some of 'em," he said. "I like to read 'em over and over. There's always something new in 'em. Besides, I ain't got no others anyway. These were father's." "Here, you little rascal, quit that," he broke off in laughing reproof as a bushy-tailed squirrel leaped to his lap and began to nose in his pockets. "Gorry, guess we'd better give them their dinner or they'll be trying to eat us," chuckled the boy. "That's Sir Lancelot. He's always first, you know." From somewhere the boy produced a small pasteboard box, which he opened guardedly, mindful of the numberless bright little eyes that were watching every move. All about him now sounded the whirr and flutter of wings, the cooing of doves, the saucy twitter of the sparrows. Sir Lancelot, alert and eager, occupied one arm of the wheelchair. Another bushy-tailed little fellow, less venturesome, sat back on his haunches 5 feet away. A third squirrel chattered noisily on a neighboring tree branch. From the box the boy took a few nuts, a small roll, and a doughnut. At the latter he looked longingly, hesitatingly. "Did you bring anything?" he asked then. "Lots, in here," nodded Pollyanna, tapping the paper bag she carried. "Oh, then perhaps I will eat it today," sighed the boy, dropping the doughnut back into the box with an air of relief. Pollyanna, on whom the significance of this action was quite lost, thrust her fingers into her own bag, and the banquet was on. It was a wonderful hour. To Pollyanna it was, in a way, the most wonderful hour she had ever spent, for she had found someone who could talk faster and longer than she could. This strange youth seemed to have an inexhaustible fund of marvelous stories of brave knights and fair ladies, of tournaments and battles. Moreover, so vividly did he draw his pictures that Pollyanna saw with her own eyes the deeds of valor, the knights in armor, and the fair ladies with their jeweled gowns and tresses, even though she was really looking at a flock of fluttering doves and sparrows and a group of frisking squirrels on a wide sweep of sunlit grass. The ladies' aiders were forgotten. Even the glad game was not thought of. Pollyanna, with flushed cheeks and sparkling eyes, was trailing down the golden ages led by a romance-fed boy who, though she did not know it, was trying to crowd into this one short hour of congenial companionship countless dreary days of loneliness and longing. Not until the noon bells sent Pollyanna hurrying homeward did she remember that she did not even know the boy's name. "I only know it isn't Sir James," she sighed to herself, frowning with vexation. "But never mind, I can ask him tomorrow." End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 8. Jamie. Pollyanna did not see the boy tomorrow. It rained, and she could not go to the garden at all. It rained the next day, too. Even on the third day she did not see him, for though the sun came out bright and warm, and though she went very early in the afternoon to the garden and waited long, he did not come at all. But on the fourth day he was there in his old place, and Pollyanna hastened forward with a joyous greeting. "Oh, I'm so glad, glad to see you! But where have you been? You weren't here yesterday at all." "I couldn't. The pain wouldn't let me come yesterday," explained the lad, who was looking very white. "The pain? Oh, does it ache?" stammered Pollyanna, all sympathy at once. "Oh, yes, always," nodded the boy, with a cheerfully matter-of-fact air. "Most generally I can stand it and come here just the same, except when it gets too bad, same as 'twas yesterday.
then I can't." "But how can you stand it, to have it ache always?" gasped Pollyanna.
"Why, I have to," answered the boy, opening his eyes a little wider. "Things that are so, and they can't be any other way. So what's the use, thinking how they might be? Besides, the harder it aches one day, the nicer 'tis to have it let up the next."
"I know, that's like the g—" began Pollyanna, but the boy interrupted her. "Did you bring a lot this time?" he asked anxiously. "Oh, I hope you did. You see, I couldn't bring them any today. Jerry couldn't spare even a penny for peanuts this morning, and there wasn't really enough stuff in the box for me this noon."
Pollyanna looked shocked.
"You mean that you didn't have enough to eat yourself for your luncheon?"
"Sure," smiled the boy, "but don't worry. 'Tisn't the first time, and 'twon't be the last. I'm used to it. Hi there, here comes Sir Lancelot."
Pollyanna, however, was not thinking of squirrels. "And wasn't there any more at home?"
"Oh, no, there's never any left at home," laughed the boy. "You see, Mumsy works out, stairs and washings, so she gets some of her feed in them places. And Jerry picks his up where he can, except nights and mornings. He gets it with us then, if we've got any."
Pollyanna looked still more shocked. "But what do you do when you don't have anything to eat?"
"Go hungry, of course."
"But I never heard of anybody who didn't have anything to eat," gasped Pollyanna.
"Of course, Father and I were poor, and we had to eat beans and fish balls when we wanted turkey. But we had something. Why don't you tell folks, all these folks everywhere that live in these houses?"
"What's the use?"
"Why, they'd give you something, of course." The boy laughed once more, this time a little queerly.
"Guess again, kid. You've got another one coming. Nobody I know is dishing out roast beef and frosted cake for the asking. Besides, if you didn't go hungry once in a while, you wouldn't know how good taters and milk can taste, and you wouldn't have so much to put in your jolly book."
"Your what?"
The boy gave an embarrassed laugh and grew suddenly red.
"Forget it. I didn't think, for a minute, but you was Mumsy or Jerry."
"But what is your jolly book?" pleaded Pollyanna. "Please tell me. Are there knights and lords and ladies in that?"
The boy shook his head. His eyes lost their laughter and grew dark and fathomless.
"No. I wished there was," he sighed wistfully. "But when you can't even walk, you can't fight battles and win trophies, and have fair ladies hand you your sword, and bestow upon you the golden guerdon."
A sudden fire came to the boy's eyes. His chin lifted itself as if in response to a bugle call. Then as suddenly the fire died, and the boy fell back into his old listlessness.
"You just can't do nothin'," he resumed wearily, after a moment's silence. "You just have to sit and think. In times like that, your think gets to be something awful. Mine did, anyhow. I wanted to go to school and learn things, more things than just Mumsy can teach me. And I thought of that. I wanted to run and play ball with the other boys, and I thought of that. I wanted to go out and sell papers with Jerry, and I thought of that. I didn't want to be taken care of all my life, and I thought of that."
"I know. Oh, I know," breathed Pollyanna with shining eyes. "Didn't I lose my legs for a while?"
"Did you? Then you do know some. But you've got yours again."
"I hain't, you know," sighed the boy, the shadow in his eyes deepening.
"But you haven't told me yet about the jolly book," prompted Pollyanna after a minute.
The boy stirred and laughed shamefacedly.
"Well, you see, it ain't much, after all, except to me. You wouldn't see much in it. I started it a year ago. I was feelin' specially bad that day. Nothin' was right. For a while I grumped it out, just thinkin', and then I picked up one of Father's books and tried to read. And the first thing I see was this. I learned it afterwards, so I can say it now. Pleasures lie thickest where no pleasures seem. There's not a leaf that falls upon the ground but holds some joy of silence or of sound. Footnote Blanchard, Lyric Offerings, Hidden Joys. Back to reading. Well, I was mad. I wished I could put the guy that wrote that in my place and see what kind of joy he'd find in my leaves. I was so mad I made up my mind I'd prove he didn't know what he was talking about. So I begun to hunt for him, the joys in my leaves, you know. I took a little old empty notebook that Jerry had given me, and I said to myself that I'd write 'em down. Everything that had anything about it that I liked, I'd put down in the book. Then I'd just show how many joys I had. "Yes, yes," cried Pollyanna absorbedly, as the boy paused for breath. "Well, I didn't expect to get many, but do you know, I got a lot. There was something about most everything that I liked a little, so in it had to go. The very first one was the book itself, that I'd got it, you know, to write in. Then somebody give me a flower in a pot, and Jerry found a dandy book in the subway. After that, it was really fun to hunt 'em out. I'd find 'em in such queer places sometimes." Then one day Jerry got hold of the little notebook and found out what 'twas. Then he give it its name, the Jolly Book, and that's all. All? All? Cried Pollyanna, delight and amazement struggling for the mastery on her glowing little face. Why, that's the game. You're playing the glad game, and don't know it. Only you're playing it ever and ever so much better than I ever could. Why, I couldn't play it at all, I'm afraid, if I didn't have enough to eat and couldn't ever walk or anything, she choked. The game? What game? I don't know anything about any game, frowned the boy. Pollyanna clapped her hands. I know you don't. I know you don't, and that's why it's so perfectly lovely and so wonderful. But listen, I'll tell you what the game is. And she told him. Gee, breathed the boy appreciatively when she had finished. Now what do you think of that? And here you are playing my game better than anybody I ever saw, and I don't even know your name yet, nor anything, exclaimed Pollyanna, in almost awestruck tones. But I want to. I want to know everything. Pooh! There's nothing to know, rejoined the boy, with a shrug. Besides, see, here's poor Sir Lancelot and all the rest waiting for their dinner, he finished. Dear me! So they are, sighed Pollyanna, glancing impatiently at the fluttering and chattering creatures all about them. Recklessly, she turned her bag upside down and scattered her supplies to the four winds. There, now that's done, and we can talk again, she rejoiced. And there's such a lot I want to know. First, please, what is your name? I only know it isn't Sir James. The boy smiled. No, it isn't, but that's what Jerry most always calls me. Mumsy and the rest call me Jamie. Jamie? Pollyanna caught her breath and held it suspended. A wild hope had come to her eyes. It was followed almost instantly, however, by fearful doubt. Does Mumsy mean mother? Sure. Pollyanna relaxed visibly. Her face fell. If this Jamie had a mother, he could not, of course, be Mrs. Carew's Jamie, whose mother had died long ago. Still, even as he was wonderfully interesting. But where do you live? She catechized eagerly. Is there anybody else in your family but your mother and Jerry? Do you always come here every day? Where is your jolly book? Mayn't I see it? Don't the doctors say you can ever walk again? And where was it you said you got it? This wheelchair, I mean. The boy chuckled. Say, how many of them questions do you expect me to answer all at once?
I'll begin at the last one, anyhow, and work backwards, maybe, if I don't forget what they be. I got this chair a year ago. Jerry knew one of them fellers what writes for papers, you know, and he put it in about me, how I couldn't ever walk and all that, and the Jolly Book, you see. The first thing I knew, a whole lot of men and women come one day totin' this chair, and said 'twas for me, that they'd read all about me, and they wanted me to have it to remember them by.
My, how glad you must have been!
I was. It took a whole page of my Jolly Book to tell about that chair.
But can't you ever walk again? Pollyanna's eyes were blurred with tears.
It don't look like it. They said I couldn't.
Oh, but that's what they said about me. And then they sent me to Dr. Ames, and I stayed most a year. And he made me walk. Maybe he could you.
The boy shook his head. He couldn't, you see. I couldn't go to him anyway. 'Twould cost too much. We'll just have to call it that I can't ever walk again. But never mind. The boy threw back his head impatiently.
I'm trying not to think of that. You know what it is when your think gets to going.
Yes, yes, of course. And here I am talking about it, cried Pollyanna, penitently.
I said you knew how to play the game better than I did now. But go on. You haven't told me half yet. Where do you live? And is Jerry all the brothers and sisters you've got?
A swift change came to the boy's face. His eyes glowed.
Yes, and he ain't mine, really. He ain't any relation, nor Mumsy ain't neither. And only think how good they've been to me.
What's that? Questioned Pollyanna, instantly on the alert. Isn't that Mumsy your mother at all?
No, and that's what makes...
And haven't you got any mother? Interrupted Pollyanna in growing excitement.
No, I never remember any mother, and father died 6 years ago.
How old were you?
I don't know. I was little. Mumsy says she guesses maybe I was about 6. That's when they took me, you see.
And your name is Jamie?
Pollyanna was holding her breath.
Why, yes, I told you that.
And what's the other name?
Longingly, but fearfully, Pollyanna asked this question.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't remember. I was too little, I suppose. Even the Murphys don't know. They never knew me as anything but Jamie.
A great disappointment came to Pollyanna's face, but almost immediately a flash of thought drove the shadow away.
Well, anyhow, if you don't know what your name is, you can't know it isn't Kent, she exclaimed.
Kent? Puzzled the boy.
Yes, began Pollyanna, all excitement. You see, there was a little boy named Jamie Kent that...
She stopped abruptly and bit her lip. It had occurred to Pollyanna that it would be kinder not to let this boy know yet of her hope that he might be the lost Jamie. It would be better that she make sure of it before raising any expectations. Otherwise she might be bringing him sorrow rather than joy. She had not forgotten how disappointed Jimmy Bean had been when she had been obliged to tell him that the lady's aid did not want him, and again when at first Mr. Pendleton had not wanted him either. She was determined that she would not make the same mistake a third time. So very promptly now she assumed an air of elaborate indifference on this most dangerous subject, as she said, "But never mind about Jamie, Kent. Tell me about yourself. I'm so interested."
"There isn't anything to tell. I don't know anything nice," hesitated the boy. "They said father was queer and never talked. They didn't even know his name. Everybody called him the Professor. Mumsy says he and I lived in a little back room on the top floor of the house in Lowell, where they used to live. They were poor then, but they wasn't near so poor as they are now. Jerry's father was alive them days and had a job."
"Yes?" "Yes, go on," prompted Pollyanna.
"Well, Mumsy says my father was sick a lot, and he got queerer and queerer, so that they had me downstairs with them a good deal. I could walk then a little, but my legs wasn't right. I played with Jerry and the little girl that died. Well, when father died, there wasn't anybody to take me, and some men were going to put me in an orphan asylum, but Mumsey says I took on so, and Jerry took on so, that they said they'd keep me, and they did. The little girl had just died, and they said I might take her place, and they've had me ever since, and I fell and got worse, and they're awful poor now, too, besides Jerry's father dying, but they've kept me. Now ain't that what you call being pretty good to a feller?"
"Yes, oh yes," cried Pollyanna. "But they'll get their reward. I know they'll get their reward." Pollyanna was quivering with delight now. The last doubt had fled. She had found the lost Jamie. She was sure of it. But not yet must she speak. First Miss Carew must see him. Then, even Pollyanna's imagination failed when it came to picturing the bliss in store for Mrs. Carew and Jamie at that glad reunion. She sprang lightly to her feet in utter disregard of Sir Lancelot, who had come back and was nosing in her lap for more nuts. "I've got to go now, but I'll come again tomorrow. Maybe I'll have a lady with me that you'll like to know. You'll be here tomorrow, won't you?" she finished anxiously. "Sure, if it's pleasant. Jerry totes me up here most every morning. They fixed it so he could, you know, and I bring my dinner and stay till 4 o'clock. Jerry's good to me, he is."
I know, nodded Pollyanna. "And maybe you'll find somebody else to be good to you, too," she caroled. With which cryptic statement and a beaming smile, she was gone. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 9, Plans and Plottings. On the way home, Pollyanna made joyous plans. Tomorrow, in some way or other, Mrs. Carew must be persuaded to go with her for a walk in the public garden. Just how this was to be brought about, Pollyanna did not know, but brought about it must be. To tell Mrs. Carew plainly that she had found Jamie and wanted her to go to see him was out of the question. There was, of course, a bare chance that this might not be her Jamie, and if it were not, and if she had thus raised in Mrs. Carew false hopes, the result might be disastrous. Pollyanna knew from what Mary had told her that twice already Mrs. Carew had been made very ill by the great disappointment of following alluring clues that had led to some boy very different from her dead sister's son. So Pollyanna knew that she could not tell Mrs. Carew why she wanted her to go to walk tomorrow in the public garden. But there would be a way, declared Pollyanna to herself, as she happily hurried homeward. Fate, however, as it happened, once more intervened in the shape of a heavy rainstorm, and Pollyanna did not have to more than look out of doors the next morning to realize that there would be no public garden stroll that day. Worse yet, neither the next day nor the next saw the clouds dispelled, and Pollyanna spent all 3 afternoons wandering from window to window, peering up into the sky, and anxiously demanding of everyone, "Don't you think it looks a little like clearing up?" So unusual was this behavior on the part of the cheery little girl, and so irritating was the constant questioning, that at last Mrs. Carew lost her patience. "For pity's sake, child, what is the trouble?" she cried. "I never knew you to fret so about the weather. Where's that wonderful glad game of yours today?" Pollyanna reddened and looked abashed. "Dear me, I reckon maybe I did forget the game this time," she admitted. "And of course there is something about it I can be glad for, if I'll only hunt for it. I can be glad that It will have to stop raining sometime, 'cause God said he wouldn't send another flood. But you see, I did so want it to be pleasant today."
"Why especially?"
"Oh, I just wanted to go to walk in the public garden." Pollyanna was trying hard to speak unconcernedly. I thought maybe you'd like to go with me, too."
Outwardly, Pollyanna was nonchalance itself. Inwardly, however, she was a quiver with excitement and suspense.
"I go to walk in the public garden?" queried Mrs. Carew, with brows slightly uplifted. "Thank you. No, I'm afraid not," she smiled.
"Oh, but you wouldn't refuse?" faltered Pollyanna in quick panic.
"I have refused."
Pollyanna swallowed convulsively. She had grown really pale.
"But, Mrs. Carew, please, please don't say you won't go when it gets pleasant," she begged. "You see, for a special reason I wanted you to go with me just this once."
Mrs. Carew frowned. She opened her lips to make the no more decisive, but something in Pollyanna's pleading eyes must have changed the words, for when they came, they were a reluctant acquiescence.
"Well, well, child, have your own way. But if I promise to go, you must promise not to go near the window for an hour, and not to ask again today if I think it's going to clear up."
"Yes'm, I will. I mean, I won't," palpitated Pollyanna.
Then, as a pale shaft of light that was almost a sunbeam came aslant through the window, she cried joyously, "But you do think it is going to—"
"Oh!" She broke off in dismay and ran from the room. Unmistakably, it cleared up the next morning. But though the sun shone brightly, there was a sharp chill in the air, and by afternoon, when Pollyanna came home from school, there was a brisk wind. In spite of protests, however, she insisted that it was a beautiful day out, and that she should be perfectly miserable if Mrs. Carew would not come for a walk in the public garden. And Mrs. Carew went, though still protesting. As might have been expected, it was a fruitless journey. Together, the impatient woman and the anxious-eyed little girl hurried shiveringly up one path and down another. Pollyanna, not finding the boy in his accustomed place, was making frantic search in every nook and corner of the garden. To Pollyanna it seemed that she could not have it so. Here she was in the garden, and here with her was Mrs. Carew, but not anywhere to be found was Jamie, and yet not one word could she say to Mrs. Carew. At last, thoroughly chilled and exasperated, Mrs. Carew insisted on going home, and despairingly Pollyanna went. Sorry days came to Pollyanna then. What to her was perilously near a second deluge, but according to Mrs. Carew was merely the usual fall rains, brought a series of damp, foggy, cold, cheerless days filled with either a dreary drizzle of rain, or worse yet, a steady downpour. If perchance occasionally there came a day of sunshine, Pollyanna always flew to the garden, but in vain. Jamie was never there. It was the middle of November now, and even the garden itself was full of dreariness. The trees were bare, the benches almost empty, and not one boat was on the little pond. True, the squirrels and pigeons were there, and the squirrels were as pert as ever. But to feed them was almost more of a sorrow than a joy, for every saucy switch of Sir Lancelot's feathery tail but brought bitter memories of the lad who had given him his name, and who was not there.
"And to think I didn't find out where he lived," mourned Pollyanna to herself over and over again as the days passed. "And he was Jamie. I just know he was Jamie. And now I'll have to wait and wait till spring comes, and it's warm enough for him to come here again. And then maybe I shan't be coming here by that time. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. And he was Jamie. I know he was Jamie." Then one dreary afternoon the unexpected happened. Pollyanna, passing through the upper hallway, heard angry voices in the hall below, one of which she recognized as being Mary's, while the other voice was saying, "Not on your life. It's nix on the begging business. Do yer get me? I wants ter see the kid, Pollyanna. I got a message for her from Sir James. Now beat it, will ye, and trot out the kid if ye don't mind." With a glad little cry, Pollyanna turned and fairly flew down the stairway. "Oh, I'm here! I'm here! I'm right here!" she panted, stumbling forward. "What is it? Did Jamie send you?" In her excitement, she had almost flung herself with outstretched arms upon the boy when Mary intercepted a shocked, restraining hand. Miss Pollyanna, do you mean to say you know this beggar boy?" The boy flushed angrily, but before he could speak, Pollyanna interposed valiant championship. "He isn't a beggar boy. He belongs to one of my very best friends. Besides, he's the one that found me and brought me home that time I was lost." Then to the boy she turned with impetuous questioning. "What is it? Did Jamie send you?" "Sure he did. He hit the hay a month ago, and he ha'n't been up since." "He hit what?" puzzled Pollyanna. "Hit the hay. Went ter bed. He's sick. I mean, he wants ter see ye. Will ye come?" "Sick? Oh, I'm so sorry," grieved Pollyanna. "Of course I'll come. I'll go get my hat and coat right away." "Miss Pollyanna!" gasped Mary in stern disapproval. "As if Mrs. Carew would let you go anywhere with a strange boy like this." "But he isn't a strange boy," objected Pollyanna. "I've known him ever so long, and I must go. What in the world is the meaning of this?" demanded Mrs. Carew icily from the drawing-room doorway. "Pollyanna, who is this boy, and what is he doing here?" Pollyanna turned with a quick cry. "Oh, Mrs. Carew, you'll let me go, won't you?"
"Go where?"
"To see my brother, ma'am," cut in the boy hurriedly, and with an obvious effort to be very polite. "He's sort of off his feed, you know, and he wouldn't give me no peace till I come up after her," with an awkward gesture toward Pollyanna. "He thinks a sight, and all of her." "I may go, mayn't I?" pleaded Pollyanna. Mrs. Carew frowned. "Go with this boy? You? Certainly not, Pollyanna. I wonder you are wild enough to think of it for a moment." "Oh, but I want you to come, too," began Pollyanna. "I? Absurd child, that is impossible. You may give this boy here a little money if you like, but—" "Thank you, ma'am, but I didn't come for money," resented the boy, his eyes flashing. "I come for her." "Yes, and Mrs. Carew, it's Jerry Murphy, the boy that found me when I was lost and brought me home," appealed Pollyanna. "Now won't you let me go?" Mrs. Carew shook her head. "It is out of the question, Pollyanna."
"But he says the other boy is sick and wants me."
"I can't help that."
"And I know him real well, Mrs. Carew. I do, truly. He reads books, lovely books, all full of knights and lords and ladies, and he feeds the birds and squirrels, and gives 'em names and everything. And he can't walk, and he doesn't have enough to eat lots of days," panted Pollyanna. "And he's been playing my glad game for a year, and didn't know it, and he plays it ever and ever so much better than I do. And I've hunted and hunted for him ever and ever so many days. Honest and truly, Mrs. Carew, I've just got to see him," almost sobbed Pollyanna. "I can't lose him again." An angry color flamed into Mrs. Carew's cheeks. "Pollyanna, this is sheer nonsense. I am surprised. I am amazed at you for insisting upon doing something you know I disapprove of. I cannot allow you to go with this boy. Now please let me hear no more about it." A new expression came to Pollyanna's face, With a look half terrified, half exalted, she lifted her chin and squarely faced Mrs. Carew. Tremulously but determinedly, she spoke. "Then I'll have to tell you. I didn't mean to till I was sure. I wanted you to see him first. But now I've got to tell. I can't lose him again. I think, Mrs. Carew, he's Jamie."
"Jamie? Not my Jamie?" Mrs. Carew's face had grown very white.
"Yes."
"Impossible."
"I know, but please, his name is Jamie, and he doesn't know the other one. His father died when he was 6 years old, and he can't remember his mother. He's 12 years old, he thinks. These folks took him in when his father died, and his father was queer, and didn't tell folks his name, and—"
But Mrs. Carew had stopped her with a gesture. Mrs. Carew was even whiter than before, but her eyes burned with a sudden fire.
"We'll go at once," she said. "Mary, tell Perkins to have the car here as soon as possible. Pollyanna, get your hat and coat. Boy, wait here, please. We'll be ready to go with you immediately."
The next minute she had hurried upstairs. In the hall, the boy drew a long breath.
"Gee whiz," he muttered softly, "if we ain't goin' ter go in a buzz wagon. Some class ter that. Gory, what'll Sir James say?"
End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 10. In Murphy's Alley. With the opulent purr that seems to be peculiar to luxurious limousines, Mrs. Carew's car rolled down Commonwealth Avenue and out upon Arlington Street to Charles. Inside sat a shining-eyed little girl and a white-faced, tense woman. Outside, to give directions to the plainly disapproving chauffeur, sat Jerry Murphy, inordinately proud and insufferably important. When the limousine came to a stop before a shabby doorway in a narrow, dirty alley, the boy leaped to the ground, and with the ridiculous imitation of the liveried pomposities he had so often watched, threw open the door of the car and stood waiting for the ladies to alight. Pollyanna sprang out at once, her eyes widening with amazement and distress as she looked about her. Behind her came Mrs. Carew, visibly shuddering as her gaze swept the filth, the sordidness, and the ragged children that swarmed shrieking and chattering out of the dismal tenements and surrounded the car in a second. Jerry waved his arms angrily. "Here, you, beat it!" he yelled to the motley throng. "This ain't no free movies. Can that racket and get a move on ye! Lively, now! We gotta get by. Jamie's got company!" Mrs. Carew shuddered again and laid a trembling hand on Jerry's shoulder.
"Not here!" she recoiled. But the boy did not hear. With shoves and pushes from sturdy fists and elbows, he was making a path for his charges. And before Mrs. Carew knew quite how it was done, she found herself with the boy and Pollyanna at the foot of a rickety flight of stairs in a dim, evil-smelling hallway. Once more she put out a shaking hand. "Wait," she commanded huskily. "Remember, don't either of you say a word about his being possibly the boy I'm looking for. I must see for myself first, and question him."
"Of course," agreed Pollyanna.
"Sure, I'm on," nodded the boy. "I gotta go right off anyhow, so I won't bother ye none. Now toddle easy up these 'ere stairs. There's always holes, and most generally there's a kid or two asleep somewheres. And the elevator ain't runnin' ter-day," he jibed, cheerfully. "We gotter go to the top, too."
Mrs. Carew found the holes, broken boards, that creaked and bent fearsomely under her shrinking feet,
And she found one kid, a 2-year-old baby, playing with an empty tin can on a string, which he was banging up and down on the second flight of stairs. On all sides, doors were opened, now boldly, now stealthily, but always disclosing women with tousled heads or peering children with dirty faces. Somewhere a baby was wailing piteously. Somewhere else a man was cursing. Everywhere was the smell of bad whiskey, stale cabbage, and unwashed humanity. At the top of the third and last stairway, the boy came to a pause before a closed door.
"I'm just thinking what Sir James'll say when he's wise ter the prize package I'm bringin' him," he whispered in a throaty voice. "I know what Mumsy'll do. She'll turn on the weeps in no time to see Jamie so tickled."
The next moment he threw wide the door with a gay, "Here we be," and, "We come in a buzz wagon. Ain't that going some, Sir James?" It was a tiny room, cold and cheerless and pitifully bare, but scrupulously neat. There were here no tousled heads, no peering children, no odors of whiskey, cabbage, and unclean humanity. There were 2 beds, 3 broken chairs, a dry goods box table, and a stove with a faint glow of light that told of a fire not nearly brisk enough to heat even that tiny room. On one of the beds lay a lad with flushed cheeks and fever-bright eyes. Near him sat a thin, white-faced woman, bent and twisted with rheumatism. Mrs. Carew stepped into the room, and, as if to steady herself, paused a minute with her back to the wall. Pollyanna hurried forward with a low cry, just as Jerry, with an apologetic, "I gotta go now, goodbye," dashed through the door.
"Oh, Jamie, I'm so glad I've found you," cried Pollyanna. "You don't know how I've looked and looked for you every day, but I'm so sorry you're sick."
Jamie smiled radiantly and held out a thin white hand. "I ain't sorry. I'm glad," he emphasized meaningly. "'Cause it's brought you to see me. Besides, I'm better now, anyway. Mumsy, this is the little girl, you know, that told me the glad game. And Mumsy's playing it, too," he triumphed, turning back to Pollyanna. First, she cried 'cause her back hurts too bad to let her work. Then, when I was took worse, she was glad she couldn't work, 'cause she could be here to take care of me, you know." At that moment, Mrs. Carew hurried forward, her eyes half fearfully, half longingly on the face of the lame boy in the bed.
"It's Mrs. Carew. I've brought her to see you, Jamie," introduced Pollyanna in a tremulous voice.
The little twisted woman by the bed had struggled to her feet by this time and was nervously offering her chair. Mrs. Carew accepted it without so much as a glance. Her eyes were still on the boy in the bed.
"Your name is Jamie?" she asked with visible difficulty.
"Yes, ma'am." The boy's bright eyes looked straight into hers. "What is your other name?"
"I don't know."
"He is not your son?" For the first time, Mrs. Carew turned to the twisted little woman who was still standing by the bed.
"No, madam."
"And you don't know his name?"
"No, madam, I never knew it."
With a despairing gesture, Mrs. Carew turned back to the boy.
"But think, think, don't you remember anything of your name but Jamie?"
The boy shook his head. Into his eyes was coming a puzzled wonder.
"No, nothing."
"Haven't you anything that belonged to your father, with possibly his name in it?"
"There wasn't anything worth savin' but them books," interposed Mrs. Murphy.
"Them's his. Maybe you'd like to look at 'em," she suggested, pointing to a row of worn volumes on a shelf across the room. Then, in plainly uncontrollable curiosity, she asked, "Was you thinking you knew him, ma'am?"
"I don't know," murmured Mrs. Carew, in a half-stifled voice, as she rose to her feet and crossed the room to the shelf of books. There were not many,
perhaps 10 or a dozen. There was a volume of Shakespeare's plays, an Ivanhoe, a much-thumbed Lady of the Lake, a book of miscellaneous poems, a coverless Tennyson, a dilapidated Little Lord Fauntleroy, and two or three books of ancient and medieval history. But though Mrs. Carew looked carefully through every one, she found nowhere any written word. With a despairing sigh, she turned back to the boy, and to the woman, both of whom now were watching her with startled, questioning eyes. "I wish you'd tell me, both of you, all you know about yourselves," she said brokenly, dropping herself once more into the chair by the bed. And they told her. It was much the same story that Jamie had told Pollyanna in the public garden. There was little that was new, nothing that was significant, in spite of the probing questions that Mrs. Carew asked. At its conclusion, Jamie turned eager eyes on Mrs. Carew's face. "Do you think you knew my father?" he begged. Mrs. Carew closed her eyes and pressed her hand to her head. "I don't know," she answered, "but I think not." Pollyanna gave a quick cry of keen disappointment, but as quickly she suppressed it in obedience to Mrs. Carew's warning glance. With new horror, however, she surveyed the tiny room. Jamie, turning his wondering eyes from Mrs. Carew's face, suddenly awoke to his duties as host. "Wasn't you good to come?" he said to Pollyanna gratefully. "How's Sir Lancelot? Do you ever go to feed him now?" Then, as Pollyanna did not answer at once, he hurried on, his eyes going from her face to the somewhat battered pink in a broken-necked bottle in the window. "Did you see my posy? Jerry found it. Somebody dropped it, and he picked it up. Ain't it pretty? And it smells a little." But Pollyanna did not seem even to have heard him. She was still gazing wide-eyed about the room, clasping and unclasping her hands nervously. "But I don't see how you could ever play the game here at all, Jamie," she faltered. "I didn't suppose there could be anywhere such a perfectly awful place to live," she shuddered. "Ho!" scoffed Jamie valiantly. "You'd oughter see the Pikes downstairs. Theirs is a whole lot worse than this. You don't know what a lot of nice things there is about this room. Why, we get the sun in that winder there for most 2 hours every day when it shines, and if you get real near it you can see a whole lot of sky from it. If we could only keep the room. But you see, we've got to leave. We're afraid, and that's what's worrying us."
"Leave?"
"Yes. We got behind on the rent, Mumsy being so sick, and not earning anything." In spite of a courageously cheerful smile, Jamie's voice shook. "Miss Dolan, downstairs, the woman what keeps my wheelchair for me, you know, is helping us out this week. But, of course, she can't do it always, and then we'll have to go, if Jerry don't strike it rich or something."
"Oh, but can't we?" began Pollyanna. She stopped short. Mrs. Carew had risen to her feet abruptly with a hurried, "Come, Pollyanna, we must go." Then to the woman she turned wearily. "You won't have to leave. I'll send you money and food at once, and I'll mention your case to one of the charity organizations in which I am interested, and they will." In surprise, she ceased speaking. The bent little figure of the woman opposite had drawn itself almost erect. Mrs. Murphy's cheeks were flushed. Her eyes showed a smoldering fire. "Thank you, no, Mrs. Carew," she said tremulously, but proudly. "We're poor, God knows, but we ain't charity folk."
"Nonsense," cried Mrs. Carew sharply. "You're letting the woman downstairs help you. This boy said so."
"I know, but that ain't charity," persisted the woman, still tremulously. "Mrs. Dolan is my friend. She knows I'd do her a good turn just as quick. I have done 'em for her in times past. Help from friends ain't charity. They care. And that makes a difference. We
wa'n't always as we are now, you see, and that makes it hurt all the more, all this. Thank you, but we couldn't take your money." Mrs. Carew frowned angrily. It had been a most disappointing, heartbreaking, exhausting hour for her. Never a patient woman, she was exasperated now, besides being utterly tired out. "Very well, just as you please," she said coldly. Then, with vague irritation, she added, "But why don't you go to your landlord and insist that he make you even decently comfortable while you do stay? Surely you're entitled to something besides broken windows stuffed with rags and papers. And those stairs that I came up are positively dangerous." Mrs. Murphy sighed in a discouraged way. Her twisted little figure had fallen back into its old hopelessness. "We have tried to have something done, but it's never amounted to anything. We never see anybody but the agent, of course, and he says the rents are too low for the owner to put out any more money on repairs." "Nonsense," snapped Mrs. Carew, with all the sharpness of a nervous, distraught woman who has at last found an outlet for her exasperation. "It's shameful. What's more, I think it's a clear case of violation of the law. Those stairs are, certainly. I shall make it my business to see that he's brought to terms. What is the name of that agent, and who is the owner of this delectable establishment?" "I don't know the name of the owner, madam, but the agent is Mr. Dodge." "Dodge?" Mrs. Carew turned sharply, an odd look on her face. "You don't mean Henry Dodge?" "Yes, madam. His name is Henry, I think." A flood of color swept into Mrs. Carew's face, then receded, leaving it whiter than before. "Very well, I'll attend to it," she murmured, in a half-stifled voice, turning away. "Come, Pollyanna, we must go now." Over at the bed, Pollyanna was bidding Jamie a tearful good-bye. "But I'll come again. I'll come real soon," she promised brightly, as she hurried through the door after Mrs. Carew. Not until they had picked their precarious way down the three long flights of stairs and through the jabbering, gesticulating crowd of men, women, and children that surrounded the scowling Perkins and the limousine did Pollyanna speak again. But then she scarcely waited for the irate chauffeur to slam the door upon them before she pleaded, "Dear Mrs. Carew, please, please say that it was Jamie. Oh, it would be so nice for him to be Jamie." "But he isn't Jamie." "Oh, dear, are you sure?" There was a moment's pause. Then Mrs. Carew covered her face with her hands. "No, I'm not sure. And that's the tragedy of it," she moaned. "I don't think he is. I'm almost positive he isn't. But, of course, there is a chance, and that's what's killing me." "Then can't you just think he's Jamie?" begged Pollyanna. "And play he was? Then you could take him home, and—" But Mrs. Carew turned fiercely. "Take that boy into my home when he wasn't Jamie? Never, Pollyanna, I couldn't." "But if you can't help Jamie, I should think you'd be so glad there was someone like him you could help," urged Pollyanna tremulously. "What if your Jamie was like this Jamie, all poor and sick, and wouldn't you want someone to take him in and comfort him, and—" Don't, Pollyanna," moaned Mrs. Carew, turning her head from side to side in a frenzy of grief. "When I think that maybe, somewhere, our Jamie is like that—" Only a choking sob finished the sentence. "That's just what I mean. That's just what I mean," triumphed Pollyanna excitedly. "Don't you see? If this is your Jamie, of course you'll want him. And if it isn't, you couldn't be doing any harm to the other Jamie by taking this one. And you'd do a whole lot of good, for you'd make this one so happy, so happy. And then, by and by, if you should find the real Jamie, you wouldn't have lost anything, but you'd have made two little boys happy instead of one. And—" But again Mrs. Carew interrupted her. "Don't, Pollyanna, don't. I want to think. I want to think."
Tearfully, Pollyanna sat back in her seat. By a very visible effort, she kept still for one whole minute. Then, as if the words fairly bubbled forth of themselves, there came this:
"Oh, but what an awful, awful place that was! I just wish the man that owned it had to live in it himself, and then see what he'd have to be glad for."
Mrs. Carew sat suddenly erect. Her face showed a curious change. Almost as if in appeal, she flung out her hand toward Pollyanna. "Don't," she cried. Perhaps she didn't know Pollyanna. Perhaps she didn't know. I'm sure she didn't know she owned a place like that. But it will be fixed now. It will be fixed."
"She? Is it a woman that owns it? And do you know her? And do you know the agent, too?"
"Yes." Mrs. Carew bit her lips. "I know her. And I know the agent."
"Oh, I'm so glad," sighed Pollyanna. "Then it'll be all right now."
"Well, it certainly will be better," avowed Mrs. Carew with emphasis, as the car stopped before her own door. Mrs. Carew spoke as if she knew what she was talking about, and perhaps, indeed, she did, better than she cared to tell Pollyanna. Certainly, before she slept that night, a letter left her hands addressed to one Henry Dodge, summoning him to an immediate conference as to certain changes and repairs to be made at once in tenements she owned. There were, moreover, several scathing sentences concerning rag-stuffed windows and rickety stairways that caused this same Henry Dodge to scowl angrily and to say a sharp word behind his teeth, though at the same time he paled with something very like fear. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Pollyanna Grows Up. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Mary Anderson. Pollyanna Grows Up by Eleanor H. Porter. Chapter 11. A Surprise for Mrs. Carew. The matter of repairs and improvements having been properly and efficiently attended to, Mrs. Carew told herself that she had done her duty, and that the matter was closed. She would forget it. The boy was not Jamie. He could not be Jamie. That ignorant, sickly, crippled boy, her dead sister's son? Impossible. She would cast the whole thing from her thoughts. It was just here, however, that Mrs. Carew found herself against an immovable, impassable barrier. The whole thing refused to be cast from her thoughts. Always before her eyes was the picture of that bare little room and the wistful-faced boy. Always in her ears was that heartbreaking, "What if it were Jamie?" And always, too, there was Pollyanna. For even though Mrs. Carew might, as she did, silence the pleadings and questionings of the little girl's tongue, there was no getting away from the prayers and reproaches of the little girl's eyes. Twice again, in desperation, Mrs. Carew went to see the boy, telling herself each time that only another visit was needed to convince her that the boy was not the one she sought. But even though, while there in the boy's presence, she told herself that she was convinced, once away from it, the old, old questioning returned. At last, in still greater desperation, she wrote to her sister, and told her the whole story. "I had not meant to tell you," she wrote, after she had stated the bare facts of the case. "I thought it a pity to harrow you up, or to raise false hopes. I am so sure that it is not he, and yet, even as I write these words, I know I am not sure. That is why I want you to come, why you must come. I must have you see him." "I wonder,"
Oh, I wonder what you'll say. Of course, we haven't seen our Jamie since he was 4 years old. He would be 12 now. This boy is 12, I should judge. He doesn't know his age. He has hair and eyes not unlike our Jamie's. He is crippled, but that condition came upon him through a fall 6 years ago, and was made worse through another one 4 years later. Anything like a complete description of his father's appearance seems impossible to obtain. But what I have learned contains nothing conclusive either for or against his being poor Doris's husband. He was called the Professor, was very queer, and seemed to own nothing save a few books. This might or might not signify. John Kent was certainly always queer, and a good deal of a bohemian in his tastes. Whether he cared for books or not, I don't remember. Do you? And, of course, the title Professor might easily have been assumed, if he wished, or it might have been merely given him by others. As for this boy, I don't know. I don't know. But I do hope you will. Your distracted sister, Ruth. Della came at once, and she went immediately to see the boy. But she did not know. Like her sister, she said she did not think it was their Jamie. But at the same time there was that chance. It might be he after all. Like Pollyanna, however, she had what she thought was a very satisfactory way out of the dilemma. "But why don't you take him, dear?" she proposed to her sister. "Why don't you take him and adopt him? It would be lovely for him, poor little fellow. And—" But Mrs. Carew shuddered and would not even let her finish.
"No, no, I can't! I can't!" she moaned. "I want my Jamie, my own Jamie, or no one."
And with a sigh, Della gave it up and went back to her nursing. If Mrs. Carew thought that this closed the matter, however, she was again mistaken, for her days were still restless, and her nights were still either sleepless or filled with dreams of a maybe or a might be, masquerading as an it is so. She was, moreover, having a difficult time with Pollyanna. Pollyanna was puzzled. She was filled with questionings and unrest. For the first time in her life, Pollyanna had come face to face with real poverty. She knew people who did not have enough to eat, who wore ragged clothing, and who lived in dark, dirty, and very tiny rooms. Her first impulse, of course, had been to help. With Mrs. Carew she had made 2 visits to Jamie, and greatly did she rejoice at the changed conditions she found there after that man Dodge had tended to things. But this, to Pollyanna, was a mere drop in the bucket. There were yet all those other sick-looking men, unhappy-looking women, and ragged children out in the street, Jamie's neighbors. Confidently she looked to Mrs. Carew for help for them also.
"Indeed!" exclaimed Mrs. Carew, when she learned what was expected of her. "So you want the whole street to be supplied with fresh paper, paint, and new stairways, do you? Pray, is there anything else you'd like?"
"Oh, yes! Lots of things," sighed Pollyanna happily. "You see, there are so many things they need, all of them. And what fun it will be to get them! How I wish I was rich so I could help, too. But I'm most as glad to be with you when you get them."
Mrs. Carew quite gasped aloud in her amazement. She lost no time, though she did lose not a little patience, in explaining that she had no intention of doing anything further in Murphy's Alley, and that there was no reason why she should. No one would expect her to. She had cancelled all possible obligations, and had even been really very generous, anyone would say, in what she had done for the tenement where lived Jamie and the Murphys. That she owned the tenement building she did not think it necessary to state. At some length she explained to Pollyanna that there were charitable institutions, both numerous and efficient, whose business it was to aid all the worthy poor, and that to these institutions she gave frequently and liberally.
Even then, however, Pollyanna was not convinced.
"But I don't see," she argued, "why it's any better or even so nice for a whole lot of folks to club together and do what everybody would like to do for themselves. I'm sure I'd much rather give Jamie a nice book now than to have some old society do it. And I know he'd like it better to have me do it, too."
"Very likely," returned Mrs. Carew, with some weariness and a little exasperation. "But it is just possible that it would not be so well for Jamie as if that book were given by a body of people who knew what sort of one to select." This led her to say much, also, none of which Pollyanna in the least understood, about pauperizing the poor, the evils of indiscriminate giving, and the pernicious effect of unorganized charity. "Besides," she added, in answer to the still perplexed expression on Pollyanna's worried little face, "very likely if I offered help to these people, they would not take it. You remember Mrs. Murphy declined at the first to let me send food and clothing, though they accepted it readily enough from their neighbors on the first floor, it seems."
"Yes, I know," sighed Pollyanna, turning away. "There's something there somehow that I don't understand. But it doesn't seem right that we should have such a lot of nice things, and that they shouldn't have anything, hardly."
As the days passed, this feeling on the part of Pollyanna increased rather than diminished, and the questions she asked and the comments she made were anything but a relief to the state of mind in which Mrs. Carew herself was. Even the test of the glad game in this case Pollyanna was finding to be very near a failure, for as she expressed it, "I don't see how you can find anything about this poor people business to be glad for. Of course we can be glad for ourselves that we aren't poor like them, but whenever I'm thinking how glad I am for that, I get so sorry for them that I can't be glad any longer. Of course, we could be glad there were poor folks, because we could help them. But if we don't help them, where's the glad part of that coming in?" And to this Pollyanna could find no one who could give her a satisfactory answer. Especially she asked this question of Mrs. Carew. And Mrs. Carew, still haunted by the visions of the Jamie that was, and the Jamie that might be, grew only more restless, more wretched, and more utterly despairing. Nor was she helped any by the approach of Christmas. Nowhere was there glow of holly or flash of tinsel that did not carry its pang to her, for always, to Mrs. Carew, it but symbolized a child's empty stocking, a stocking that might be Jamie's. Finally, a week before Christmas, she fought what she thought was the last battle with herself. Resolutely, but with no real joy in her face, she gave terse orders to Mary and summoned Pollyanna. "Pollyanna," she began almost harshly, "I have decided to take Jamie. The car will be here at once. I'm going after him now and bring him home. You may come with me if you like." A great light transfigured Pollyanna's face.
Oh, how glad I am," she breathed. "Why, I'm so glad. I want to cry. Mrs. Carew, why is it when you're the very gladdest of anything you always want to cry?"
"I don't know, I'm sure, Pollyanna," rejoined Mrs. Carew abstractedly. On Mrs. Carew's face there was still no look of joy. Once in the Murphys' little one-room tenement, it did not take Mrs. Carew long to tell her errand. In a few short sentences she told the story of the lost Jamie, and of her first hopes that this Jamie might be he. She made no secret of her doubts that he was the one. At the same time, she said she had decided to take him home with her and give him every possible advantage. Then, a little wearily, she told what were the plans she had made for him. At the foot of the bed, Mrs. Murphy listened, crying softly. Across the room, Jerry Murphy,
his eyes dilating, emitted an occasional low, "Gee, can you beat that now?" As to Jamie, Jamie on the bed had listened at first with the air of one to whom suddenly a door has opened into a longed-for paradise. But gradually, as Mrs. Carew talked, a new look came to his eyes. Very slowly he closed them and turned away his face. When Mrs. Carew ceased speaking, there was a long silence before Jamie turned his head and answered. They saw then that his face was very white, and that his eyes were full of tears. "Thank you, Mrs. Carew, but I can't go," he said simply.
"You can't what?" cried Mrs. Carew, as if she doubted the evidence of her own ears.
"Jamie!" gasped Pollyanna.
"Oh, come on, kid, what's eatin' ye?" scowled Jerry, hurriedly coming forward. "Don't you know a good thing when you see it?"
"Yes, but I can't go," said the crippled boy again.
"But Jamie, Jamie, think what it would mean to you," quavered Mrs. Murphy at the foot of the bed.
"I am a-thinking," choked Jamie. "Don't you suppose I know what I'm doing, what I'm giving up?" Then to Mrs. Carew he turned tear-wet eyes. "I can't," he faltered. "I can't let you do all that for me. If you cared, it would be different. But you don't care, not really. You don't want me, not me. You want the real Jamie, and I ain't the real Jamie. You don't think I am. I can see it in your face."
"I know, but," began Mrs. Carew helplessly.
"And it isn't as if I was like other boys and could walk either," interrupted the cripple feverishly. "You'd get tired of me in no time, and I'd see it comin'. I couldn't stand it to be a burden like that. Of course, if you cared, like Mumsy here," he threw out his hand, choked back a sob, then turned his head away again. "I'm not the Jamie you want. I can't go," he said. With the words, his thin, boyish hand fell clenched till the knuckles showed white against the tattered old shawl that covered the bed. There was a moment's breathless hush. Then, very quietly, Mrs. Carew got to her feet. Her face was colorless, but there was that in it that silenced the sob that rose to Pollyanna's lips. "Come, Pollyanna," was all she said. "Well, if you ain't the fool limit," babbled Jerry Murphy to the boy on the bed, as the door closed a moment later. But the boy on the bed was crying very much, as if the closing door had been the one that had led to paradise, and that had closed now forever. End of chapter 11.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets, with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.